This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Financial magazines across the country touted Enron as the most innovative company in America. Then it all came crumbling down. The collapse of the zillion-dollar Houston-based energy trader marked the flaming tail end of the high-growth, higher-hype new economy. With the freewheeling economy of the 90s behind us, where will the path of American business lead now? Tonight, we're talking with Joseph Nocera, executive editor of Fortune magazine, about the next phase in the post.com, post-new paradigm, post-Enron business world. The future will be in the honest economy, he says, where stock market speculation takes a back seat as companies resist unreal pressure to inflate their real bottom lines. What do you think the next phase will be? What values of the new economy will be preserved? What old economy features are reappearing? And what will be cast aside? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from New York is Joseph Nocera, executive editor at Fortune magazine. He's part of a team of Fortune writers working on a new book about Enron. Good evening and welcome, Joe Nocera.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. Also with us is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Joe.
Hey, Jack, how are you?
Well, good. It's good to hear your voice.
Same here.
Joe Nocera, there's plenty to say about Enron, and we know that you're up to your hips in it, but we're also trying to look through the smoke and fire there tonight and see what was it about the culture, the business culture of the 1990s that helped lead to this debacle, and as we clamber out of it, what's on the other side? Let's look back first, Joe, if you would. What do
Sure.
you see in the business culture that helped produce Enron?
Well, the simple answer is everybody went crazy for stocks, and going crazy for stocks turned into basically greed.
But what's new about that, Joe? Isn't that the American way?
Well, it goes in phases. You know, in the market, the two things that drive the market are fear and greed, once you get past the fear point and into this greed point, people lose their. People become delusional about what their expectations are, what ought to happen, what stocks ought to do. There's no realism. It becomes a giant absurdity, and that's what we've just been through.
What's the downside of that focus, that super focus on stocks?
Well, there's two essential problems. From the investor point of view, they stop thinking rationally, and they just start to think, well, you know, I don't care that, you know, Priceline doesn't make any money as long as the stock's going up.
It's got a buzz.
So the connection between the price of the stock and what's actually going on inside a company becomes disconnected. And eventually it will get back connected again, and that will be bad for the person who's invested in the stock. Mm-hmm. But the other side of it has to do with the Wall Street analyst and the company executives themselves, who all also become part of this mythologizing and begin to believe that the stock price matters more than the company, and getting the stock price up is the only thing that matters. And they go from viewing the stock as the end result of doing things inside a company to being the only thing you should care about, which leads some people and some companies to go astray. Enron is a dramatic example of a company that went astray, but it's clearly not the only one out there.
Do you see the super magnet of the overinflated, overheated stock market as what led people off an ethical path as well?
Yeah, I do. People don't remember this, but the whole business about earnings expectations, where every quarter Wall Street sets this bar that companies have to jump over, and and there's this, you know, they have to announce whether they're going to make their earnings expectation and blah, blah, blah. That didn't exist 25 years ago. That's a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, we used to live in a world where a company would announce what its earnings were, and, you know, if the earnings were good, the stock would go up a little. If the earnings went down, the stock would went down a little. But it wasn't. It was an element of gamesmanship that was introduced into the system in the 80s and 90s. And the gamesmanship, in particular, is what has really run amok, and has really been a distorting factor in warping a lot of people's values.
Do you think the gamesmanship is now at an end, Joe Nocera?
I think it is right now. Whether it will, what troubles me is that nobody is out there saying earnings expectations and all that stuff needs to go away, which I actually believe it does need to go away. What's good about what's happened, you know, every bubble eventually bursts, and once it bursts, people say, "Oh God, what were we thinking? We need to do it better this time." And in this case, several things have happened that are that I think are fairly significant and healthy. The first thing that's happened is that people have woken up to the extent to which the profits that they thought were there are illusory, legal but illusory. Not all profits, but, you know, so many companies were figuring out ways to make their profit picture look better than that, than it deserved to be or ought to be.
Way too much for comfort.
And 2 years ago, nobody cared about that, and now everybody cares about it. And so all of a sudden, you see situations where IBM and General Electric, which certainly have, you know, they're real companies, they have real businesses, you can't argue with that, but they do funny things with their numbers. And suddenly, that's become verboten, and that's very good. So there's a marketplace discipline that's healthy, that's washing out a lot of the excess in the system. The second thing that's going to happen, though, is that there will be a regulatory response, particularly regarding the accounting firms and some of the accounting rules that allowed companies to book these illusory profits. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if Enron had not shredded documents, it would have been hard to make a case that they violated the law. I think you could make the case, but it would be a really hard case to make. Whereas, you know, now that they've violated documents, it's actually going to be a pretty easy
case. That
in
itself is the case.
So, you know, it's the old Mike Kinsley dicta, which is, you know, the scandal isn't what's illegal. The scandal is what's legal.
So, Joe Nocera, what are we headed toward then if there's a regulatory response, as you describe it, more regulation, and earnings expectations somehow go away? That's an economy more regulated and less focused on earnings that most Americans can't even remember ever having been part of an economy like that. What will an economy like that feel like? How will it perform? How will it act?
It's a little hard to say because in the world of the 50s and 60s, which is the time when people didn't care that much about the stock market, it wasn't a factor in their everyday life. That's more akin to a world where, you know, the people who stretched the rules were the outliers. They weren't the mainstream. That's the critical difference between then and now.
So is it going to feel like Welcome Home Cotter again? Is it going to be the 1950s
all over
America?
And this is where it gets tricky, because the difference between then and now, and this is where we can't revert back whether we'd like to or not, is the stock market and stocks themselves have become too important to people's lives. So in the 50s and 60s, you know, you didn't think about a 401k plan because you had a company pension plan, and that's, you know, the democratization and the complication of finance and the way you have to take care of your own money and you have to invest and, you know, for your retirement and college and so on, that didn't exist. And so what you've got is a situation where we're about to head into this path where there's going to be a reversal. Because, you know, once you start recording honest profits instead of illusory profits,
you're on a different path.
Profits are going to come down for a while. And there's going to be, you know, the market's going to come down for a while. But people unlike 30 years ago, can't just say, oh, that's just Wall Street, because it affects their lives directly. And that's the layer of complication that hasn't gotten sorted out yet and that still needs to be – people are going to have to go through this, I think fairly painful period.
It's going to take a while to get our heads around that. You're describing a world kind of running in reverse, and yet, Jack Beatty, as Joe Nocera says, we can't go backwards. People were told 401k is the way, get in the market and you're on your way. How do we move beyond that mindset? It seems it's cemented into everybody's life now.
Yeah, that's a part of this that is, as Joe said, is problematic. I mean, on the one hand, we've democratized investment. On the other hand, if you follow this right down through the causal chain, what is driving companies to come up with the best possible quarterly earnings at all costs? The institutional investors who hold our 401ks. So who is it that's driving the instability in the financial world? Well, the capitalist, c'est moi. It's our pensions. And this has even led in the 90s to a kind of cannibalistic economy. That is to say, well, you've lost your job at AT&T, but you preserved your pension. Just think,
yeah, you're great.
You know, in 96, AT&T announced they're going to lay off 40,000 people. The stock went up, and so did the pensions of some of the people who had been let off. And so in a strange way, they had to sacrifice themselves as employees in order to strengthen themselves as investors. Now, this is an anomaly. And Joe is one of the theorists of the sort of democratization of the economy, and it's an important phenomenon. But Joe, I think this anomaly of the instability driven by us and by our pensions is something we got to face up to.
Joe Nocera, are you the guy to blame for all this?
No, of course I'm not. I just documented a phenomenon. I wanted to say two things about that. We did a documentary in I believe 96.
Yeah.
About the democratization of money for Frontline. Mm-hmm. And we did actually have a woman on the show who had been laid off from Citibank, and the stock went down to $10.
Yeah.
And she didn't sell a share. In fact, she went and bought more because she said, I don't have a job anymore, but they did the right thing, in her view. And then by the time we went to see her, the stock was back up to 80, and she was cheering with both fists. I mean, it is this bizarre internal left brain, right brain conflict of interest that people now have. I agree with Jack that it is the institutions, but I also think it's the whole – I think it's bigger than that. I just think it's the culture. It's stock options. Mm-hmm. It's we're all going to get rich. It's the stock. People just had this illusion that you could quit your job at 35 and be a millionaire because the stock market was going to take care of you, and it doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way unless you're Mark Cuban, with the Dallas Mavericks.
So is this going to be a boring economy for Americans, Joe Nocera, after the 90s?
Well, I certainly don't think so because, we're writing stories about Global Crossing and mm-hmm. Tyco.
Well, it won't be boring in that sense. It'll be bombs.
We're having a great time writing about this stuff. It probably will be a little boring. It's one of the – people are funny. When the market is going up, your neighbors want to talk to you about stocks.
Sure.
And everybody's reading the papers and the magazines. And I can tell you that our magazines, the Time Inc., Money, and Fortune, I'm thinking of in particular, mm-hmm. do much better on the newsstand in an up market than in a down market. And it doesn't matter how much hard we try. When you get into a down market, people have a hard time facing what has happened to them personally.
Mm-hmm.
Their portfolios are down 60%, 70%. They realize they made some dumb mistakes.
Mm.
And it's not so much that it's boring, it's that it's just hard to face.
You
and
don't so want to look at it.
They don't read the newspaper. They don't want to read the magazines. One signal that's of somebody who's really good at this is somebody who can face their mistakes and what they did wrong. One of the things – just – I'm sorry I'm going all over the place here, but
– go for it, Jim.
One of the things about democratization that I've sort of come to realize post the book, which I wrote in 94, mm-hmm. was it's hard to be a good investor. It's not an easy thing. It requires a lot of counterintuitive thinking, and it requires an iron stomach that most of us don't have, and a lack of emotionalism that most of us don't have. Mm. And it's, you know, one of the things that's wrong about the current system is that it's sort of saying that you're required to have this psychology to have a good life. And that really is, I have to say, ridiculous.
It sounds like we're talking about bailing out of the stock market and just going back to the job. Americans, does that sound exciting to you after the 90s? Is that good enough to keep you going? Where is America's economic energy headed now? We had stagflation in the 1970s, Reagan's greed is good 80s, and the 90s boom and bust. What's next for the U.S. economy? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. From Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The point is that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will save that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA.
That was Michael Douglas, of course, as Gordon Gekko, corporate shark in the 1987 movie Wall Street. We're talking about the next phase of the American economy. If greed was good and then the stock market was good, what's good in the decade ahead? Our guest tonight is Joseph Nocera. He's executive editor at Fortune magazine. He's working as part of a team of Fortune writers on a new book about Enron. And we're asking, what's up next? What do you see coming? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joe Nocera says you may have to get a little less familiar with your stock market portfolio and more familiar with good old-fashioned work. Or Joe Nocera, is that the message here? Gordon Gekko says greed is good. What was the move from the 80s to the 90s? What changed there? And what's the next step in this kind of unending American march forward?
Well, I mean, I view the 80s and the late 80s and the late 90s in very similar terms, mm-hmm. which is to say you had a giant run-up, people got overexcited, some people did things they shouldn't have done, and once the bubble burst, two things happened. People who had done things wrong that had been overlooked for a while got caught, and secondly, people needed to have a villain for what had transpired, and Michael Milken was the what became the Enron of the 80s, mm-hmm. the villain of the 80s. Mm-hmm. All the layoffs, all the jobs, you know, everything that people were angry about, he took the hit for that. Rightly or wrongly, I would say more mm-hmm. rightly than wrongly, but that's a whole other subject.
But then when we come to the 90s, this new element comes in, an ideology, almost a theology, the new economy line that we had new efficiencies, new technology, that we new paradigms. It was all that strictly mythology, Joe Nocera, or is there something that was brewing there, maybe even something at the heart of Enron that wasn't corrupt but actually trying to be genuinely new? And do we lose that now? Can we really go back?
No, we don't lose it. We don't lose it at all. I mean, look, it's no different than the building of the railroad,
mm-hmm.
or the creation of the light bulb, or you know, when it's new, it's just incredibly exciting and powerful, and people want to race into it. Mm. It's like the invention of the automobile. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were hundreds of car companies once in this country,
sure.
and people were investing them in them like crazy, and they all lost money. That's the great thing. I mean, they all lost money, but out of that, you know, a great industry was born.
But as Enron collapses, all we hear is the hail of criticism. You don't hear much about, I mean, it's almost, you know, a heresy to say it now. But was Enron in some part actually moving the economy forward in a more efficient, unregulated, market-driven and somehow positive direction that we shouldn't throw out with the bathwater here?
Well, I guess I make a distinction between sort of the pure Internet
mm-hmm.
And Enron. I mean, in some ways, as I think about it now, Enron used the veneer of the Internet to create the illusion that they were a new economy company when, in fact, they were nothing of the sort. They were basically traders, and they asked them, they were traders. That's what they were.
Yep.
I mean, big deal. They've been traders forever. Mm-hmm. They're hundreds, centuries. It's a centuries-old tradition.
Mm-hmm.
What I would say is that has Amazon done something important and interesting? Has eBay, has the extent to which the Internet affects your life now and the coming of broadband? And, another good example, Tom, is the telecom disaster
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where all these companies, built fiber optic networks that would, speed content across the country and across the world like crazy and make mm-hmm. broadband passable. All those companies have collapsed. There mm-hmm. was a total rush in. It was a total bubble. It was total insanity. And now, guess what? All these companies are going away. Some of them are going to turn out to be semi-crooked like Global Crossing. But we have this fiber optic network, and eventually it will get used, and it will be a good thing.
Mm. Joe Nocera, you talk about what's coming up next as the honest economy. A, what do you mean by that? And B, can the United States have the kind of high growth it's become accustomed to in an honest economy?
I didn't actually realize that I had coined that phrase, but I really like it. So let's stick with it.
Okay. we were told you had.
Well, I guess I did. 5 o'clock this afternoon.
Good for you. It's new.
No is the answer to the growth question. One of the things that's going to have to happen is this kind of ratcheting down of expectations and a realization that reality is not always fast growing. It's more volatile. It's life is not about beating your earnings quarter after quarter by a penny.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about, climbing 60% a quarter. It's just that stuff is an absurdity. It's an absurdity. And the bigger a company gets, the harder it gets. I mean, reality needs to impose itself here. And what I mean by the honest economy is simply that I believe that companies are going to be rewarded, at least for now, and hopefully for years into the future, for not bending the rules, playing tricks, doing the mm-hmm. things that companies have been doing over the past decade to make their numbers look better than they have. And I would hope also that in the course of this, Wall Street analysts come to realize that their first loyalty should be to investors and not to the investment banks and deal making.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that the accountants, who by law, are supposed to put the investor first and not the company that's mm-hmm. putting money in their pocket, will come back to that. And so, I guess what I'm saying is that in the course of righting this ship, there's going to be some pain, and a lot of that pain is going to come around the realization that a lot of the stock growth over the last few years, four or five years really, yeah. was undeserved.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, Joe Nocera is using some very straightforward language here, honest economy, but it's cod liver oil we're talking about. It comes with lower growth. That has a lot of implications.
Yeah, honest economy, but what about the honest people? Paul Krugman says that Enron is a bigger story for us, a more paradigmatic story for our era than September 11th, because when we look in it, we see something about ourselves. And this is something very unflattering. Here we have a class of men who graduates of the best schools, accountants, traders, executives, boards of directors, the whole galaxy of people connected to this, one and all fattening their own prospects while lashing their employees to the mast. This is a kind of class war here. This is the rich turning on the rest of us. And we have to ask, What does it, you know, I mean, the people at the Harvard Business School and other business schools have to say, well, wait a minute, if we're turning out Skillings and Fastow and the rest of them, what are we doing? Are we letting sharks loose in the world? And I think this predation, this feeding on the people below is one of the hallmarks of this era. You see it in executive salaries, which are now obscenely out of proportion to the average person. You see it in the attack on pensions, on benefits. You see it on the relentless attack on the right to organize. And there is a class war going on, and this is what this scandal is about.
Joe Nocera, do you see class warfare here and predation of rich on poor? And if you do, is it over now?
I'm not a class warrior the way Jack is, I guess, is one thing that I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just recognizing reality.
Well, I mean, that's your view of it. But, I agree that executive salaries are insane. So they're just it's obscene and it's wrong. I totally agree with that. But in terms of to take the Enron case, in truth, the people at Enron in the lower ranks believed, and they could have. Everybody talks about the fact that they were locked out of moving their 401k money, but at the point at which they were locked out of moving their 401k money, the stock had already sunk from $80 to $15. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if, you know, it was, I think there was an enormous amount of mass delusion going on here where people wanted to believe in this, wanted to believe in the people running the company. You know, Andy Fastow did a lot of bad things, but he didn't sell any stock. I mean, I think he believed, too. I'm not, you know, did the underlings get screwed in the end? You bet they did. But, you know, I think, frankly, they, to some small degree, they participated in their own screwing.
Listeners, where do you see the American economy heading now? Where's the energy going? If we change the rules to ensure no more Enrons, what kind of economy will we have? Joe Nocera says we're headed toward the honest economy. Are you ready for that? For a slower pace, for slower growth, maybe more regulation? Are you ready to go back, or will it be like going back? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jack is on the line. Welcome, Jack. You're on the air.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
I think that this topic's a really interesting and a very timely one. And I think that there's a lot of things that have to change at a macro level for things to get to the point where we think we all want them to be.
Where are you looking for change, Jack?
Well, I think that I can speak for myself and a lot of people that I know who've been in the high-tech world, for example, chasing after the big stock payday.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, we've had options, we've worked the extra hours, we've taken the extra business trip, all to get to the point where we can, you know, achieve that illusion of retiring at age 40 and living the good life and finding, you know,
cash out and sail that boat.
Right. So our mm-hmm. balance comes at the tail end of our life, and I believe that what's next and what's you know, cool is going to be, you know, maybe not the honest economy, because a lot of things have to happen at various levels for that to happen, but a balanced one where people are looking to balance not just, you know, not just their careers, but their life today.
Yeah.
So, you know, without taking a financial step backwards, or maybe without taking a large financial step backwards, can I get the quality of life that I want and haven't had, and balance?
Jack, we're losing you. But Jonas, here, let me put that to you. We've been hearing for years about how we have to get balance back. But is the phase change that we may be heading into now going to bring that to Americans, whether they want it or not? Is the fast life a thing of the past, at least for some people here?
I think it's more a situation where people are going to feel disillusioned. I'm talking here about the class of people who do get options and who were 2 years ago, you know, calculating their net worth every day, mm-hmm. thinking this is going to allow me to retire at the age of 40. And now that whole class of people knows that isn't true, and that they have to, you know, basically they're going to be in the workforce for as long as their parents were, and they're going to have to, you know, save for their retirement and
but
all that.
But there's so much that follows from that, Joe. As our caller Jack said, it was that golden cash out that had him working all those hours and those weekends and taking those extra trips. If the big cash out isn't there, is it going to change the very tempo of American business? Will people be unwilling to lash themselves to the job in the same way?
Well, I actually think that people are as motivated by my short answer is no. I think people are going to wind up working just as hard, which is not necessarily a good thing, mm-hmm. I might add, mm-hmm. Partly because of fear, i.e., will I get to keep my job in a down economy, mm-hmm. And partly because at the really good companies, you know, they have a way of instilling mission and making people feel like they're doing something deeply useful and making a difference, and they become invested in the job. And this gets us into this whole area that's really not what this hour is about. But I do think that the psychological component of work is still at least as important as the financial, and will drive people to work just as hard as they did before.
Maybe getting back to works for work's sake. But I wonder, Joe, I took a little tiptoe to those new economy tulips, and I saw people just working like madmen and women. It's hard to imagine them working quite that same way without that.
I would agree with that. But most Americans did not work as you did in a dot-com startup with all the insanity that went with that. But on the other hand, you know, in the 1960s, we were told that you know, by now, you know, people would be working 30 hours a week and we'd have all this more leisure time. And of course, that has never happened. And it seems fairly clear now that it never will happen.
Andrew's on the line. Welcome, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, Jack. Thanks. I'd just like to hope that we are getting into the what doesn't kill you makes you stronger economy.
Okay. But, what do you mean by that, Andrew?
Well, that we've learned from this experience, mm-hmm. that, you know, you learn the most from making the biggest mistakes, mm-hmm. Provided they don't kill you. So that hopefully there are a lot of people who put money into Amazon, into Yahoo and Enron, and they got burned, but they looked back and said, what was I doing and what did I do wrong? The best piece of investment advice I probably ever heard was invest in what you know. Mm-hmm. So you had a lot of investors out there who were investing in the dot-coms, and you could go up to them and you ask, well, what do you know about co-location hosting, or what do you know about, you know, e-commerce? And you'd get an answer like, I don't know, but their stock's going up.
It's going like gangbusters.
Right, but, you know, then you'd have somebody who perhaps take a guy who's worked in a gas station for 10 years, and there's probably people who've gotten rich doing this, that he worked in a gas station for 10 years, saw a new product and saw what it did for cars and said, gee, where's that company? I'd like to buy some of their stock because I see what it's doing. And
Andrew,
he ends up making some money off
Andrew,
it.
Andrew, we got the picture. Joe Nocera, it sounds so prosaic somehow. Can we go back to just investing in what we know? Do you agree with Andrew that maybe this is the whack that will make us stronger because it hasn't killed us?
Would that it were so. I mean, I think here's what I think. I think if you're a first-time investor in this market, you will learn some lessons. But the problem is that every time we come to this point, the point where everything's going up and it all looks so great and everybody's making money and you're looking at your portfolio five times a day to see how much money you've made in the last hour, every time that happens, people lose their heads. They lose their wits. And this is the history of the world since tulip mania. And so, I hate to be a naysayer here, but to say that this time it will be different and that people truly will learn this time, I have to say I'm skeptical.
Well, maybe we'll learn for a while. Listeners, we're talking with Joe Nocera, executive editor at Fortune magazine. The question is, where is America's economic energy headed now on the other side of Enron? If we change the rules to ensure no more Enrons, what kind of economy will we have? Do you want to go back to more regulation, to a slower pace, to slower growth, Joe Nocera says? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the next phase of the American economy with Joseph Nocera, executive editor at Fortune magazine, and with our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. What do you think? Where is America's economic energy headed now? Simon is on the line. Welcome, Simon. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
We're well, thanks.
I just wanted to quickly point out that in light of things like Enron, it's very easy for people to want to go too far the other way, to want to really stamp down on regulation and change things that are inevitably good programs, like the 401k program we have currently.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, if we follow the same diversification strategy that we've always tried to hold to, keeping some in risk, some in less risk, depending on who you are individually, and you ride this out, eventually you're going to come back out on top.
Well, Simon, thanks for that call. Let's put it to Joe Nocera. Joe, it sounds like Simon doesn't really want to give up on the game.
A lot of people don't.
And I suppose that will stretch out the game because it won't end overnight. But what about, are you concerned that regulation will come back in at many levels, including 401k, in such a way that it stifles the economy? Or do we need a big swing toward regulation now?
The market, you keep talking about regulation. The market has always been regulated, at least since the since the Depression, and regulation, by and large, in the marketplace, in the stock market, has been a good thing. Brokers who defraud people need to be disciplined or disbarred or sent to prison. Insider trading should be illegal, accounting is a set of rules that are themselves regulations. And if you had no regulation of the market, it would be chaos.
Well, I guess the question goes right beyond the market, though, Joe, right out into industry, where we had the big deregulation trend, and now there's talk of just tightening up all over. Do you see a less freewheeling economy change?
I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen at all. They may well want to re-regulate energy, oil, heating people's houses. But, I don't think after California last summer and the Enron experience, I know I work for Fortune and I'm generally a free marketeer, but it's hard to say at this point that particular deregulatory experiment has been a success. Look, we got a Republican in the White House. We are not going to start re-regulating the economy, and it seems to me that on some level we do need to tighten some of the regulations regarding accounting firms, what's legal in terms of earnings and so on, and that's to the good. I just don't see how anybody can say that's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Well, thank you.
Sure.
Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you.
Just an observation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anything's going to change, and here's why.
Okay.
We've got senior managers or administrators, if you will, coming from certain select groups of consulting firms that are actually formerly accounting firms, that are tied to the investment banking situation, and the whole business game is based on what these people understand and what they are capable of administrating. Leadership in the marketplace today, or in the creation of capital, is something that got expropriated by a bunch of marketeers.
Mike, you raise a great point. Let's put it to Joe Nocera. Is there a generation, Joe, of executives raised in the go-go 80s and 90s that it will be incapable of the kind of change that you're forecasting?
Look, I think the change is really will take place if one thing happens. One thing. People go to jail. It just you start sending some of these white collar guys to jail. They will. Everybody else is going to change, and it's like you can't slap them on the wrist. You can't give them a fine. You can't let them off. You put them in jail.
So put them in jail. But do the executives at the top now know how to manage in the honest economy?
Oh, I think a lot of them do. I think. The notion that everybody out there is Enron, I don't think is true, basically. I do think a lot of the excess is getting flushed through the system, and that a lot of people are going to get in trouble, and hopefully some of them will go to jail, and it will be a good corrective for people at other companies who are thinking, well, you know, gosh, I did a couple of things that maybe we shouldn't have done in our firm, and I'm glad we didn't get caught, and we're gonna unwind it, and we're gonna stop it,
and that's the end of all
we
that.
Did. But the thing you got to remember is that a lot of this stuff that has gone on was legal, and it was slimy, but it was legal. And so what you really need is a you put guys across the line in jail, but then you also, this is why you have to regulate. You have to say off balance sheet partnerships where you only have to give up 3% of the equity and you don't have to put it on your balance sheet. You can't do that anymore.
No,
it's
more
wrong.
Courtney's on the line. Welcome, Courtney. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Well.
You can always expect me to give more of a gloom and doom scenario here.
Lay it on us.
Okay. I think that we need more fundamental change. I think that it's more than a matter of just, you know, smack on the wrist, a little bit of punishment. Clearly, the pressure to produce short-term results, you know, quarter-to-quarter earnings, is at play here. And we're going to need to really discourage short-term trading somehow.
Well, how do you do that? Courtney, do you have a suggestion?
Well, you have to put more taxes on people that are doing short-term trading. I'm one of them. You know, I think we're all caught up in the roulette wheel of gambling that's going on in this country right now.
Could I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Are you making money or losing money short-term trading?
I'm terrible. No, I think it's...
There you go. See, that's the corrective. That's the corrective.
Yeah, but he's still on the roulette wheel, Joe.
You can only lose so much, and then you're not going to have any more money.
Courtney, there's some stiff prognostication for you.
I actually agree with you about the companies. I mean, I think there's too much emphasis on Wall Street on short-term results and not enough credit given for companies that are making long-term investments that will pay off 2-3 years down the road. I agree with you there.
But how do we save Courtney from himself?
But if people want to be stupid and trade 5 times a day, they deserve what they get. I'm sorry, Courtney, but there you go.
Look a couple of years out, Joe. You think that short-term trading is going to be all over?
Yeah, I do. Among individual investors, I think it will be all over just because it's a sucker's game.
And the notion
that I think a lot of it's been flushed out already. It's just you can't win at the game. It's just you can't win.
But the financial advisors' constant refrain that if you stay in the market well enough, you'll be just fine. Do you still buy that, Joe Nocera?
I do believe in buy and hold. I make maybe one trade a year in my portfolio.
You're no day trader.
No, I mean, I just think day trading is for fools.
Joe Nocera, we love the glimpse ahead, and we thank you very much for coming on and helping us take it.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Next time, I hope you let Jack talk more.
We'll get to Jack. Don't you
usually
worry.
You can't shut me up. Your pearls of wisdom, we had to have them, Joe.
Joe Nocera is executive editor at Fortune Magazine. Joe, thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Jack Beatty, last word goes to you.
Well, you know, this is a historic night for the honest economy because looking ahead, we may actually get a business that doesn't depend so much on what the Russians call business, that is to say, government favors. And that's the part of this scandal that, you know, putting Enron into a regulatory black hole and so on through campaign finances. That's the part of the honest economy that that we can all look forward to. And if the Shays-Meehan bill is passed tonight, we've taken a big step in that direction.
Jack, stand by. Let's look at that. In fact, as you know, earlier today, the House of Representatives passed the basic Shays-Meehan campaign finance reform bill. Since that vote, members of Congress have been debating 13 amendments to the bill. At this point, they have voted on 5 of the amendments. At this rate, we won't know the final form of the bill for several hours. But so far, things are going as Shays-Meehan supporters have hoped. Here are some sounds from today's historic debates.
Rereading the First Amendment of our Constitution might be therapeutic. Quote, Congress shall make no law, no law, emphasis my own, respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. If ever there was a time where free speech should be unfettered, robust, it's at election time. Instead, this legislation, in essence, tells democracy to shut up and sit down.
The fact is that there is a pattern here of people who have never found much virtue in the ACLU and the First Amendment suddenly becoming believers.
One of the fundamental problems I have with this legislation is this regulation of free speech. by grassroots organizations that engage in issue advocacy and educating the public to the voting record and positions of the candidates. The base text of Shays Meehan regulates the free speech of everyone from the far left to the far right, from the pro-life movement to farmers, from veterans groups to religious organizations.
These amendments are all over the boards. This one, it is offered precisely because it is unconstitutional, because it would force the bill into conference committee, because it would effectively kill Shays Meehan.
Mr. Speaker, the only reason we have all of the soft money is because these so-called reformers with their failed reforms who gave us the present law have so restricted the amounts of money that can be contributed from hard money sources that all you have left is soft money. When they get done taking away the soft money, we will move the speech further out into these so-called special interest groups.
The addiction to soft money, all of us will be okay without it. We can find ways to pay for our golf tournaments. We can find ways to pay for our resort visits. We can find ways to pay for all of those things we pay for soft money with now. Vote for Shays Meehan.
Time of the gentleman has expired. Debate today in the House of Representatives on the Shays Meehan campaign finance reform bill. Jack Beatty, the medicine is not going down easy.
No. Speaker Hastert, the Republican speaker, has said this is a party issue and has said it's Armageddon for his party, that they will lose the House if they lose the soft money. That's quite an admission. But the parties are at parity. And taking anything out of the mix, he may well be right. This could be the loss of the House for them because it may just tip something to the Democrats. But the parties are at such equilibrium that taking anything out of the mix, anything could happen.
The unknown comes. But is that just reform scare, Jack? Because, of course, Democrats will lose soft money, too.
They sure will. And in fact, Democrats have had more soft money lately than the Republicans. But as I've said before in this program, soft money is a bigger problem for the Democrats because it essentially puts them in attention with their base. Their base are ordinary people, and soft money is not ordinary people. They're the 500,000 people who are the ruling class, you could say, who contribute and who buy politics. And the Democrats can't become a mass party if they're serving the soft money contributors.
But isn't it also union money?
It is. It is. I'm afraid to say. But of course, it's a smaller portion of the whole. And the unions made a grave mistake years ago in going along with this.
We heard Henry Hyde there at the very top saying, referring to the First Amendment, freedom of speech, and saying this is abridging that this reform, if it passes, and of course we won't know for hours yet, but he said, Henry Hyde said, this tells democracy to shut up and sit down. What about the freedom of speech argument here, Jack Beatty?
Well, you know, when you read The Economist, which is certainly a conservative mainstream publication, they can't understand this idea that money is speech. They say, wait a minute, speech, it has to do with politics, it has to do with positions. This whole idea is connecting the advertising culture with democracy. It's connecting the two parts of our system in a way that shouldn't be connected. The two parts are democracy, we're all equal, capitalism, we're unequal. This sort of takes the capitalism and it invades the democracy and it sort of subverts it. So free speech, there's an abstract argument that I just can't, and Europeans can't for the life of them fathom.
But you hear, it seemed to me, behind the Republican complaints there, a kind of fear of the future that it may all be government-financed campaigns. Is this the kind of hyperbolic fear or real issue potentially that's where we're headed as you start shutting down sources of private money?
Well, I'd like to see that, but people like me have to face up to the fact we may be making politics safe for billionaires. I mean, the amount of the John Corzine, the New Jersey senator, spent what, $60 million running for Senate?
Meaning if you can't get soft money, you'll just have to after your own pot to get in the race.
That's it. And is that what we're doing with these reforms? And people like me have to think that one through. And the way to do it is to say we've got to go all the way toward public finance.
That'll be a long run indeed, and you'll see much, much hotter debates than even tonight. But what is your feeling, Jack? If it goes through, not only tonight with these amendments going the way that the sponsors of the bill like, but then makes it through the conference committee if necessary, past a Senate filibuster, are we going to feel a real change in the atmosphere of American politics?
Well, we won't feel it until after this election cycle, because like St. Augustine, they've said, let me stay in the brothel at least for a while. Don't save me just yet. They're going to be saved after the next election. So we'll know 2004. And we'll know if we start to get things like national health insurance. That'll really tell us that we have a level playing field in American politics.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.